This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I'm Chua Untek. As the war in Gaza approaches its fourth week, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said yesterday that Hamas would pay an intolerable price for its attacks on Israel, intensifying his country's military offensive. Almost 1,700 Palestinians and 65 Israelis have died since the conflict began on July 8. Here to help us understand how the current conflict began and what it will take to bring lasting peace to the Israel-Palestine situation is Middle East scholar Gregory Harms. Gregory is the author of The Palestine-Israel Conflict, a textbook on the subject which is now in its third edition. Gregory, welcome.
Thank you.
So there are contradictory accounts on how this conflict began. Give us your take on how it started. Who is to blame here?
Well, the catalyst for this was actually an announcement made by Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas on June 2nd. On June 2nd, he announced a unity/transitional government that was based on a reconciliation agreement that had been reached by Hamas in Gaza and the Palestinian Authority, which is based in the West Bank. So at this point, So the transitional government includes no members of Hamas. So the various ministries would be based in Ramallah in the West Bank, and Hamas basically made a list of concessions and was left holding very few, if any, cards. When Abbas made this announcement, it received basically global approval, specifically and most importantly, American approval. So the White House voiced, albeit cool acceptance, kind of a we'll see what they do kind of an attitude, but basically acceptance. So when the U.S. accepted the unity government, Israel went into panic mode essentially. So 10 days later, three Israeli Jewish teenagers were kidnapped in the West Bank. They were from settlement families living not so far away from Hebron. In response, Israel conducted early AM raids throughout the territories. I was there at the time, actually. They locked down different Palestinian towns, Hebron, Nablus in the north, and they went right through the whole territory. What wasn't discussed was that Israeli intelligence had determined that the teenagers were killed just after they were abducted. But the Israeli military and police carried out these raids regardless. They saw an opportunity to impose massive pressure on Hamas. So during these raids, they arrested hundreds of Palestinians, including hundreds of Hamas members. At the same time, Israel started conducting airstrikes in Gaza. They fired on the Gazan tunnels, which killed a number of Hamas militants and wounded a number of civilians. So because of the pressure brought to bear on Hamas in the West Bank and the pressure and the airstrikes in Gaza, Hamas starts firing loads of rockets out of Gaza. It's important to bear in mind that Hamas had been adhering to a ceasefire since autumn 2012, and these were the first barrages for well over a year in direct response to Israeli provocation. So then Israel had its pretext, and it could commence Operation Protective Edge. That brings us right into the present.
So what is Israel trying to achieve with their bombings and operations today?
There's a number of reasons. This is the third time that Israel has conducted these major assaults. So 2006, and then 2008 and 9, and then...
Right, it's the third one in 5 years.
Yeah, this is becoming routine. The reasons are, it depends on how you want to read it, but a few reasons are relatively clear. One is to do what the Israeli military calls maintenance. So mowing the lawn is another term. And that's simply just to deplete Hamas's arsenal of rockets and mortars. You also have field testing. It's a great way to conduct field testing of new military technology. So, for example, the Iron Dome anti-missile system. The Israelis prefer the Palestinians politically split. So if they can, as I call it, hit the Gaza button and provoke this rocket fire, provoke a military response from Hamas, they can then go in, conduct their maintenance, and hopefully reestablish, in this case, the status quo ante, which was the political division of the Palestinians, that is, Hamas in Gaza and the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank. So this whole thing can be boiled down to Israel being totally disinterested in negotiating any kind of diplomatic settlement of the conflict.
What could U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry have done differently in Paris and Cairo before the war broke out?
Well, there's always the U.S. option to just impose pressure on Israel in general to either try to prevent these assaults, or when they start, impose pressure on Israel to discontinue them. There's always that option. The thing is, the Americans don't mind Israel conducting maintenance. If they truly did, then this some kind of diplomatic pressure, maybe behind closed doors, would be brought to bear on Israel. So the Americans are basically on board on this. It's kind of a headache, but it's not so much of a headache where they're going to spend diplomatic capital. This also buys them some diplomatic capital, because when this is all over with, then Kerry and President Obama can turn to the Israelis and say, look, we provided you cover while you carried out your operations. Now you owe us. So it's not a matter of what he could have done differently. This is standard policy. This is standard U.S. protection of Israel.
Who is Hamas and what is their ideology?
Hamas emerged in Gaza in the late 1980s. They're an Islamic resistance movement. They're an offshoot of the Muslim Brotherhood, which was created in Egypt in 1928. Their ideology is simply a religiously motivated resistance to Israeli occupation. As a matter of fact, when Hamas first emerged on the scene, 1988 was the year that they formed, the Israelis supported them and gave them money and thought that, you know, they had a good thing going where this could be a replacement of the PLO at the time. That's since stopped. But it's the whole thing is focused on resistance to Israel's occupation of, in their case, Gaza. The religious motivations tend to become overemphasized. Which is very common for American commentary and European commentary to focus on the religious aspect of all of this. But they are first and foremost a political organization with a political agenda. And had Israel not occupied Palestine in the first place, you wouldn't have these groups. You wouldn't have Hamas. You wouldn't have Islamic Jihad. You wouldn't have Hezbollah in Lebanon. So this stuff's just sort of a somewhat natural byproduct of occupying people over decades.
What is preventing Hamas and Israel from negotiating a more sustained truce?
Well, in the current conflict, Hamas, they signed a ceasefire agreement in 2012, and one of the three major terms in the truce, or the ceasefire agreement, was for the blockade of Gaza to be lifted and Israel to allow greater mobility of the population and the goods going in and out of Gaza. That never came to be.
Why has this not been possible?
Well, it's simply prevented by Israel. And so right now Hamas is concerned about, you know, they don't want to sign a ceasefire and then negotiate these terms regarding the blockade, because from their perspective, you know, their argument is, we've already been there. We signed the agreement. We adhered to the agreement. We even handed over most of our political cards to the Palestinian Authority to establish this transitional government, and none of this seems to work. So one of the only remaining cards Hamas has is their rockets and their mortar arsenal.
What is Israel willing to give up in return? It seems like they've reneged on all their promises.
There seems to be two possibilities here. When they went into this, either wanted to, like I said, reestablish a politically divided Palestine with Hamas back in charge and the unity government stressed to the point of breaking, or what you end up, which I think is more likely the case, is you have a, in either case, weakened Hamas, but you have a lot of the analysis in the Israeli press seems to indicate some sort of increased involvement of the Palestinian Authority in Gaza, so manning the border crossings, specifically the Rafah crossing in the south. With Hamas playing some sort of significant role in Gaza, but not as sort of the political leadership. So, in either case, Israel wants some kind of role for Hamas. You know, there's a misunderstanding that Israel is just looking to destroy Hamas altogether, which is not correct. Israel prefers Hamas to remain right where it is, just with no rockets, no mortars, and no tunnels. So a resistance movement that doesn't resist, but maintains some sort of internal order within Gaza, which is basically the role that the Palestinian Authority has played in the West Bank.
Because of its overwhelming firepower, casualties are always asymmetrical whenever Israel launches an operation against Hamas in Gaza. And the West always support Israel's right to defend itself. Is Israel in danger of losing its moral argument and the court of public opinion outside the West?
Well, I don't think Israel has a moral argument. So what you just said about Israel's right to self-defense. There's a lot of talk about that in terms of Western commentary and statements made by Western heads of state, principally Obama and Kerry and others. So this is constantly repeated. You know, Israel has a right to self-defense. That's correct. It does. Israel does have a right to self-defense. Every nation state has a right to self-defense. But invoking that right doesn't apply to this situation, in which case they might as well say Israel has a right to have a flag, right? All states have a right to have a flag, but it's not pertinent to the situation at hand. Israel is, according to international law, the occupying power. And because it's the occupying power, that is prior to everything else that goes on vis-a-vis Gaza in this case. So Israel has no claim to self-defense in these operations, not morally, not legally, and not logically. Until they withdraw from Palestine and allow Palestine to function on its own accord as a nation state, right? The same way that, you know, Norway and Sweden allow one another to function as normal nation states. Then and only then, if rockets flew out of Gaza, which would then be part of the state of Palestine, then Israel would have the force of law at its side, and Israel could invoke the right to self-defense.
Do they care about world opinion?
Oh, I think that, well, of course they should care. I think it's patently obvious at this point that they don't. The only real opinion Israel is concerned about is the American opinion, because the Americans provide a great deal of support to their military. The United States provides diplomatic cover for Israel. So since 1970, the Americans at the Security Council have protected Israel from censure by the Council over 40 times. And as a result, the United States has an enormous amount of sway over Israel. in the United States particularly, there's this sort of ongoing debate about, you know, to some commentators, you would think that it's the other way around, that Israel controls the United States, which defies all logic and defies the sweep of world history in terms of how power works. So the U.S. has an enormous amount of sway over Israel. Israel knows it, and Israel is functioning as a client and an adjunct to U.S. power. As for the rest of the world, I really couldn't care less. There's some concern for the EU's opinion, because the EU is Israel's largest trading partner. But beyond that, yeah, there's little concern, because Israel knows it's protected.
We're speaking today to Gregory Harms about the Israel-Palestine conflict. More coming up after the break, BFM 89.9.
This is a download from BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good afternoon and welcome back. If you've just joined us, we are speaking today to Middle East scholar Gregory Harms about the Israel-Palestine conflict. Gregory, we cannot begin to comprehend the conflict between Israel and Palestine without an understanding of the region's history. What were the antecedents that led to the creation of a Jewish state?
After World War I, the Western powers, namely Great Britain and France, divided up the Ottoman Empire into separate nation states. This was called the Mandate System. The idea was that they would divide the Ottoman Empire up into separate geopolitical designations and then tutor them in the ways of statehood, and then they would achieve independence. So all the states in the what's called the Levant, this is sort of the eastern Mediterranean area, Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, Jordan. All those states eventually achieved sovereignty and independence, with the exception of Palestine. In Palestine, you have the confluence of three factors. One was that Great Britain wanted to maintain a measure of colonial control, so it wanted to keep at least one foot planted in Palestine. You also had an increased sense of nationalism in Palestine. As the Palestinians saw the other countries achieve statehood, they, as was promised to them on a number of occasions, they felt it was their due to also achieve statehood. And then you also have the influx of Jewish immigrants and Zionists coming out of Eastern Europe and Russia that are escaping persecution there. And so you've got these three factors. You've got British colonialism, you've got Palestinian nationalism, and then you have this emerging ideology, the developing ideology called Zionism, which was to establish a safe haven state in Palestine. The problem was the goal wasn't to move into Palestine and live in peace and harmony with their Palestinian neighbors. The goal was to basically turn Palestine into Israel. And so
let's talk about Zionism for a while. It's Zionist, and Zionism has acquired a pejorative connotation among nations sympathetic to the plight of Palestinians, right? What does Zionism mean? What does it stand for, and what are its values?
Well, Zionism is just a number of references that are biblical, or you could just be the state of Israel could be referred to as Zion, and the ideology is simply to establish a safe haven state for the Jewish people. It now has sort of this pejorative connotation because of how it was implemented. The idea is fine enough to escape, persecution and these anti-Semitic, pogroms and whatnot. That's perfectly understandable. But like I said, the goal wasn't to go to Palestine and live with Palestinians. The goal was to move the Palestinians out, to quote Theodore Herzl, to spirit the penniless population away, right? So from Theodore Herzl, who was one of the key figures of Zionist history, a number of the State of Israel's founding leaders, they've all made mention, you know, not very often and quietly, you know, in journals and letters and whatnot. They all mention the need to do this, to sort of get rid of the Palestinians so they could establish a state in Palestine and call it Israel. This has been the ideology. This has been the approach. So as of 1948, the UN votes to partition Palestine into, you know, Jewish areas and Palestinian areas. And after the war of 1948, the Zionists, now Israelis, had expanded their 56% to 78%, which leaves 22% of what was mandatory Palestine to the Palestinians. That is the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, and East Jerusalem. 20 years later, during the June 67 war, Israel occupied the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem. And so that occupation has been in place ever since, and that's the core of the problem.
Is a two-state solution still possible?
The two-state solution is quite possible. It just depends on how, well, a couple factors. One, it depends on how much the Americans want to lean on Israel to negotiate the two-state settlement. And then there's also popular pressure that can be brought to bear to help improve the deal that Palestine is going to say the Palestine is going to get, namely how much of the West Bank will be annexed to settlement blocks along the what's called the Green Line, which is the 1967 border of the West Bank. That's going to take about 10% of the West Bank of these settlement blocks. The Palestinians, in a number of previous agreements. So, if you look at the Camp David 2000 under Clinton, then the follow-up Taba agreement, and then two independent diplomatic initiatives, People's Voice, and the Geneva Accords. The Palestinians have agreed to only allow Palestinian refugees back into the state of Palestine, not into Israel proper. East Jerusalem would likely be divided into Israeli areas and Palestinian areas. And now Israel's added a couple more terms that they want the Palestinians to recognize Israel as a Jewish state and its right to exist, which doesn't have any legal precedent. And then there's increased talk about what the status of the Jordan Valley, that is, the portion of the West Bank, along the Jordan River. But the two-state solution is quite possible. It just depends largely on the White House. The recent efforts by Secretary of State Kerry and President Obama, they've started very early this time. This is something new in, you know, in the diplomatic record from, say, 67 to the present. The Americans usually don't start this early, which indicates a level of seriousness on the part of the Obama administration. So it seems like this might be a possibility, but what they need to do in terms of, you know, their needs, not what they logically or morally need to do, is they need to keep these plates spinning until the end of Obama's term. You can't solve if they're in fact going to lean on Israel and basically tell the Palestinians, look, here's the deal you're going to get. Just take it. You know, here's a pen, sign it, and this is the best offer you're going to get. They need to keep this going till the end of the term.
Yeah, I want to go back a little bit and ask you, what does a Jewish state means in the context of modern-day Israel?
It just means that the your population of Israel is 8 million, and 3/4 of them are Jewish. You got a Jewish majority, but you got the Star of David on the flag, and the idea of Israel is a Jewish state. Again, what kind of legal precedent is here? And it doesn't say much for the 2 million Arab Israelis who are also living in Israel, who frequently suffer treatment as second-class citizens.
What compromises must Palestine and Israel make to arrive at a two-state solution? Because Benjamin Netanyahu has said publicly that the 1967 lines, the borders agreed in 1967, it's not possible because it's indefensible, according to his words.
Well, it's certainly possible. All they have to do is withdraw to it. And his stated security concerns about the Jordan River Valley along the eastern edge of the territory is a non-issue, unless they're really concerned that Jordan is going to invade Israel, which I would put the chances of that at around zero. Let's just call it zero. So that's him defending ideological goals, but just putting them in the language of practicality. But that's not realistic. If Israel really was interested in peace with the Palestinians, they would withdraw to the Green Line, evacuate the settlements, and that would be the end of it. But they, starting in 2002, Israel started building the barrier wall, which snakes deep inside the West Bank. It expropriates about 10% of the land, and not one inch of it is in Israel. So if you want to build a security wall, that's fine, and you can do that. But typically, if in your home, at your home, you build a fence, you build the fence in your yard. You don't build it in your neighbor's yard. And so, curiously, the path of this wall has basically prefigured what is very likely to be the final status border of the West Bank. So none of this spells an interest in genuine and honest interest in peace with the Palestinians. They want maybe peace with the Palestinians, but on their terms. They're trying to carry out this maximal project. Gaza's a non-issue. As former Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin said, best case scenario, Gaza breaks off and falls into the Mediterranean Sea. So Israel's primary concerns, as they calculate them, are to make off with as much of the West Bank as they can, and make sure that the Palestinian state is as weak and feeble and vulnerable as they can possibly make it. This has been the agenda since 1967. The then labor minister, Yigal Alon, he put forth a proposal and a map. And if you look at that map, which was created in 1967, and you look at the West Bank now, there's an eerie resemblance. So this has been the thinking from 1967 to the present.
Give us a sense of the ideological differences and political tension between the left and right wings in Israel politics today.
I would just say that the liberal left is at the thin end of the wedge. They don't have much of a voice. The approval for the current operations in Gaza are like in the 90s, right? So your liberal left is there, but they're few in number. This conflict has, not only is it obviously very bad for Palestine, it's also bad for Israel. And so I think that's something that even I can only speak for here in the United States and maybe some of Western Europe, but there's a tendency to forget that. We're so focused on the fundamental rights of the Palestinians that we forget that this is bad for Israel. And so, you know, these terms, pro-Israeli and anti-Israeli, get inverted to defend Israel's current behavior and current trajectory is an anti-Israeli proposition. But the Israelis are a highly indoctrinated society. Their press has a lot to do with this. When you're in Israel and you talk about the Palestinian territories, I mean, sometimes I talk of the West Bank and Gaza, it's like they're talking about different planets, even though they're right in their backyard. So it's a very manipulated society, and it's encouraged a lot of paranoia and a sense of militancy. And it's just, I mean, just at the psychological level, it's completely unhealthy for that country to maintain this conflict. As a footnote, the Americans are aware of this, and they don't care. So it's common for U.S.-Israeli relations to be discussed in the language of friendship. Okay, that's not friendship. But using another country as a means of projecting state power into a given region and making it basically a Spartan, you know, military state, that doesn't help that country at all. And at this point, a list of former Israeli heads of intelligence, of the intelligence community, former high-ranking military officials, they never say these things when they're doing their job, but when they retire, they do interviews, and then they say these things. And now there's a list, and there's documentaries on it, where they all say the same thing, that this conflict is bad for Israel. Right. So would we accuse, you know, former heads of Shin Bet and Mossad and generals, former generals in the military, of being anti-Israeli? So it's like I said, there's the liberal left has a voice, but it's not much of one in Israel right now. And this is a very bad situation.
Right. Let's come back to Hamas. Gaza's economy is almost entirely reliant on smuggling through tunnels bordering on Egypt, where you mentioned the town of Rafah. But with the new hardline government in Egypt destroying these tunnels and Iran no longer funding Hamas like it used to, and Hamas even struggling to pay civil servant salary working in Gaza, how long can Hamas sustain its current position?
The UN and its different organizations working in Gaza routinely say that there's a humanitarian crisis in that territory, and some reports have said, you know, by the year 2020, like, this territory can't live like this anymore. So it's not really what can Hamas do, it's what can those 1.7 million people do under these horrendous circumstances. So the tunnels help sort of like create some kind of image of an economy, but there's basically no economy in Gaza. You've got 50% unemployment. One of the largest employers in the territory is a UN refugee aid organization. If that tells you anything about the state that the territory is in, I don't think the issue is what can Hamas do. And I think ultimately at the end of this, Hamas is going to be finished again, and you're going to see an increased Palestinian Authority presence in the territory. Israel is very calculated about how it manages Gaza. It's important for your listeners to bear in mind that Gaza is an occupied territory. Right. Even though Israel disengaged in 2005, mm-hmm. Israel still maintains that occupation. It controls the airspace, it controls the land border, it controls the coastline, it controls the cellular frequency spectrum. The whole thing is very, very tightly controlled, and it's highly designed, to the point that an Israeli human rights organization called Gisha, they acquired Israeli military documents revealing that the Israelis had actually calculated what Gazans need for a daily caloric intake to prevent total disaster. So So this whole thing's finely tuned to let in just enough electricity and just enough fuel and just enough, you know, foodstuffs to keep the territory from totally falling apart. So this whole thing is highly designed and with enormous U.S. support. I always have to add that because sometimes it gets left out of the conversation.
Is this all leading to the Third Intifada?
Well, when it comes to human affairs, predictions are kind of pointless. I spent the month of June in the West Bank, and just in the month I was there, it went from relatively quiet to those teenagers being kidnapped, and then there was subsequent abduction and murder of a Palestinian teenager and the brutal beating of his cousin, and there was a hunger strike going on being conducted by Palestinian prisoners. There's not a lot of these pieces. So even in the month of June that I was there, I sensed this increase in temperature. And there's a lot of resentment against the Palestinian Authority. So their demonstrations started forming in Ramallah and elsewhere, and rocks are being thrown through the windows of Palestinian Authority offices and so on. And right now, Hamas is sort of riding an increased wave of popularity. It doesn't bode well for the Palestinian Authority. But ultimately, Third Intifada, there's a lot of talk about it. You know, it's in the commentary, and you hear, if you just talk to Palestinians, they talk about it, but it's totally impossible to tell what lies at the end of this.
Thank you, Gregory. That was Gregory Holmes, author of The Palestine-Israel Conflict, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.